Today we're thinking in this theme that God brings hope into seemingly hopeless situations. The story of Hagar seems to move from hope to hopelessness and back to an uneasy semblance of some hope. The hope comes from an unexpected quarter, but when you read about what Ishmael's going to be like, well, it's not an easy hope. It's not a fully comfortable hope, not a satisfactory. It's the situation as we go through it is a mess, and everyone involved in this is flawed. There are no heroes in the story, no characters really at this point in the story to model to our children. Human weakness causes the problem, exacerbates the problem, and prolongs the problem. And while the story doesn't end with a lose-lose situation, neither can we happily say it's a win-win situation either. It's a genuinely human story. And that's what we find is so real about the scriptures at times. It's an unvarnished story. It's a complex story. The characters in this story don't really win our sympathy for the things that they're doing. If indeed they hold up a mirror, it reflects a side of humanity we don't really want to see. And we certainly hope we don't see ourselves reflected in that either. Aspects of this story are very modern, while some are very ancient. They become modern because we are human as the characters in this story are human. And our common humanity has all sorts of things that tie us together. Today's reading brings to us questions of surrogate motherhood, played out in a culture with norms we don't understand, and nowadays find difficult, if not abhorrent. The story is complex. At the center of this are issues of infertility and longing for a child. There are sensitivities around this. These can be painful topics for those who struggle with infertility. I know there are some couples in our world who choose not to have children, but then again, there are many who would desperately love to have a child but can't. And there are all sorts of reasons why that may be so. Perhaps people struggling with fertility issues look at this story with different eyes, perhaps with a deeper understanding than some others. Really, it's not an easy story. And the people in this story are people who are in real pain, trying to find a way forward. In this case, things turn sour. People hurt each other, and that hurt is multiplied by their actions and attitudes. And the story ventures beyond those issues of infertility to those of abuse, misuse of power, bitter rivalries, and it leads to generational conflicts. In the context of this, we learn of Abraham's predicament in the previous chapter. He had no child to inherit his wealth. And so we read, "Sovereign Lord, what can you give me, since I remain childless? The one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus." And Abram said, "You've given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir." Then the word of the Lord came to him, "This man will not be your heir, but a son who is your own flesh and blood will be your heir." He took him outside and said, "Look up at the sky, count the stars, if indeed you can count them." Then he said, "So shall your offspring be." So Abraham had this promise from God, but over a period of time, still no child. And then later we read, Abraham fell down. Now, sometimes Sarah, because in the middle of the story they changed their names. So that's just the way it sort of works with this. Abraham fell on his face and he laughed and he said to himself, will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? And then later still we read one of them, that's one of the angels talking with Abraham, said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son. Now Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent, which was behind him. Abraham and Sarah were already very old, and Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, after I am worn out and my Lord is old, will I still have this pleasure? So both Abraham and Sarai laughed at the thought of having a child in their old age. But it was really no laughing matter because it was very serious for them and something they were struggling with. But in our story, things turn ugly. Perhaps in some way the laughter points to a release of tension rather than a response to something humorous. Both Abraham and Sarah were sort of wound up and on edge because of this. And it shows in their attitudes and their actions. Now, we have quite a bit of information from the ancient world about their marriage practices and things around surrogacy. So we know that from the town of Nuzi, there's a contract that stipulates, so this is 1,500 years before Christ, really, really old. So this says, if a wife is unable to bear children, she should provide her husband with a surrogate child bearer, and that she, the wife, will have authority over the child. And then also from Assyria, similar sort of time frame, if the wife does not bear a child within 2 years, she may buy a maidservant. And later, after the wife procures an infant for her husband, she can sell the slave wherever she pleases. So at that time, in that sort of society, a wife was duty-bound to produce a child either herself by herself or by means of a surrogate mother. Another ancient writing says, if she gives a slave woman to her husband and the slave bears children, after which the slave woman aspires to be equal status with her mistress because she bore a child, her mistress will not sell her, but mark her as a slave and count her among the slave women. So in different times, different places, there were slightly different approaches to this, but you see, it's nothing like our sort of expectations and knowledge. And so this ancient approach to questions of fertility, the rules that are around it, can appear to us to be abusive and cruel, hard for us to imagine that there was at one time a society in which this was quite normal. And this was part of the precarious situation women faced. One commentator I was reading wrote, infertility had the potential of causing women social difficulties. It was bad enough that people would generally consider her accursed, but in many cases her condition would serve as a cause for her to be divorced. No children, divorce, get another wife, that wife is left and abandoned. And that we struggle with those sorts of ideas. As time elapsed in a marriage, you can understand that a woman who did not become pregnant might well fear for her future and be overwhelmed with insecurity because this was a very difficult situation. Now, God had promised Abraham would have a son. 10 years had passed in Canaan. Sarai didn't become pregnant. It seemed impossible. The unfulfilled promise of a child meant with each passing year, hope was fading. Sarai and Abraham had been together for many, many years, and while they both longed for a child, even as they both grew older, it seemed as if they had grown accustomed to living like this, that this would not be a problem or an issue for them. But then Sarai came up with this idea to solve this impossible situation. Not just creative thinking, it would have been the norm, part of what she'd grown up in and seen and been part of in the society of which she lived. She may have felt duty-bound to do this. She may not have been happy about it, but felt, I've just got to do this. And Abraham agreed with her plan. So it was common practice in that day to provide a slave to be a surrogate mother. Accepted by society, nothing out of the ordinary, commonplace. There were laws put in place to deal with this sort of matter in their society. Abraham and Hagar were not in a long-term loving relationship. Hagar was a slave who could be sold and separated from her child at any moment. Although in one sense, Abraham took her as a wife, he did not offer her protection, he did not offer her security, and she as a slave had no say in the matter. She became pregnant, and realizing she was carrying Abraham's child, her attitude to Sarai changed, and she began to despise her mistress. Perhaps she had hopes of rising in the household, maybe aspiring to some sort of better situation for herself. Because imagine if her son was the heir, if Abraham died, who would her son look to? Who would be that woman of rank that he would care for? Sarai thought she was solving a problem, but instead she and Abraham were creating a more complex problem. And so she put the blame on Abraham. You are responsible for the wrong I'm suffering. We're not told, but maybe Abraham had said something to raise Hagar's hopes or expectations in some way. We don't know what has gone on there, but Sarai believes Abraham is responsible for the wrong that she's suffering. I put my slave in your arms, and now that she knows she's pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me. Although Hagar was carrying his child, Abraham just washes his hands of the whole thing, puts the responsibility back on Sarai and says, your slave is in your hands. Your slave, your problem, your hands. Do with her whatever you think best. And then Sarai ill-treated Hagar, and so she fled from her. Now, no one looks great here. No one looks good in this situation at all. Abraham treats the whole thing as Sarai's responsibility. He seems to have no attachment to the unborn child. He abdicates any responsibility for the mother or the child. Sarai is wounded by Hagar's attitude, turns nasty, ill-treats Hagar with seemingly no concern for the child that she's carrying. And having arranged this because she longed for a child, now she seems to be reneging on the deal, rejecting the mother and the child. If anyone deserves a measure of sympathy in this, it's Hagar who's been put in this difficult situation. But then she has made things worse by her pride and how she changed in her attitude towards Sarai. And where do you go if your home is not safe? Where do you go if your home is a place of abuse? Where do you go if you're vulnerable? And more so, because you're carrying a baby. Where do you turn when those who should offer you support and protection turn a blind eye to your abuser, perhaps enables them? What do you do when you have nothing and you depend on your abusers for food, for shelter, for livelihood? Her hopes are dashed, and Hagar sees the only option is to run. And she runs away. Notice neither Abraham or Sarai go looking for her. They just let her go. We're not told what's going on between Abraham and Sarai at this point, but perhaps they were both happy that the problem slave had left, taking the problem child with her. Perhaps they hope now things will get back to normal between us. Their attempt to remedy a God-sized problem with human intervention hadn't solved anything. It had made matters worse. And for them all, hope just lies in tatters. Hagar on the run, resting at the spring on her way back to Egypt. Really dangerous situation. A pregnant woman traveling alone, a runaway slave with no rights, an outsider who doesn't belong and isn't wanted, a bad situation, but God intervenes on her behalf, and soon hope begins to reemerge. The angel of the Lord engages her in a conversation. "Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from? Where are you going?" "I'm running away from my mistress Sarai," she answered. Hagar has an answer to the question, "Where have you come from? I'm running away." But she's no answer for where she's going. She may have known the road she was on, but really she was lost. Where could she turn? In a shame-based society, who would have pity on her? Who would have pity on her child? And yet God now speaks and gives to her a promise and a command. Go back to Sarai and submit to her. That is the command. This is what she was to do. But we need to take care that this is not sending her back into an abusive situation. Rather, it is to go back under the shelter of the household. Remember the words of the prodigal son when he was abandoned and hope began to flicker in him. He said to himself, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare while I starve to death?" And in the ancient world, though this seems so difficult for us to understand, provision for slaves in a household was often more advantageous to them than being free and having nothing. Hagar would need to obey rather than despise Sarai. And Sarai would need to accept rather than abuse Hagar. God's promise here, God's intervention makes a difference. God promised to increase her descendants so that they're too numerous to count. And that, in a sense, if you think about it, is covering her, at least in part, with the promise that he has given to Abraham. Abraham may not have intervened on her behalf, but God has. God has come to her aid. God has done what no one of low status would expect. God has gone looking for her. Sure, might talk to Abraham, the head of the household, the big guy. Maybe God would talk to someone like him, but to this runaway slave, would God speak to such a person? And yet we find this is what God does. Here we see hints of the good shepherd who looks for the lost lamb. Why? Because God cares for her. Now imagine what happens when Hagar returns to Sarai and to Abraham and says, "Guess who I met on the road? And guess what he told me? He's watching. He's seen it all. This is what the living Lord has said to me." Now, I don't imagine the relationship between Hagar and Sarai was ever going to be best friends forever. But for Sarai and Abraham to know that God was watching, had seen the mistreatment, had rescued her from her hopelessness, had sent her back with the promise of uncountable descendants, I think their attitudes and their actions would have changed straight away. God is here. God is watching. This slave is important to God. In time, Abraham even wondered if Ishmael may be the one. If only he could live under your blessing, Lord. Because years and years still passed before Sarah gave birth to a son. So God told Hagar the child was to be named Ishmael, meaning God hears. The E-L at the end of Ishmael is Hebrew, is the Hebrew word for God. God hears. This name given to the child by God is not simply a name, but a recognition, almost a promise. Ishmael would know by his name, God hears, God listens. He would carry around with him this name that would help him to understand whatever his situation, God was being attentive, God was listening. Now this touches on another sensitive matter that we don't have time to explore. Was Ishmael a mistake? Certainly Sarai and Abraham were mistaken in their efforts. But Ishmael himself is not a mistake. If anyone in this story is truly innocent, it's this unborn child. And by naming this child and claiming this child and embracing this child, God is saying something special about the unborn child. No child is a mistake in the eyes of God. Even if the circumstances around their birth may seem questionable to human eyes, to God every life is precious. And not only is God the one who hears, here's something very special happens. Hagar gives God a name. Now, the scholar that I was reading said no one else does this. No one else gives God a name. God may reveal his names, but here Hagar gives God a name, El Roy, the one who sees me. And this is amazing, that God cares for the runaway slave Hagar, a runaway murderer, Moses, a runaway prophet, Jonah, a runaway king, David, a runaway me, a runaway you. It's amazing. God is watching. God has noticed her plight. God sees me. He didn't look past Hagar. He didn't look through her. He didn't lose sight of her. And she discovers this and confesses, God sees me, even me. And she's learning what others would come to learn. He who watches over Israel neither sleeps nor slumbers. The eyes of the Lord are everywhere. Nothing in creation is hidden from God's sight. And so what difference does this make to us? We know that our God is a God of hope. Not a vague hope, but real and sustaining hope. The promise of Advent as we come to it, thinking about the Messiah who will come. This gives hope to us as it gave hope to those who held on to this promise. And so we also want to speak hope into the sense of White Ribbon Day, supporting Shine. We know that things are difficult in our society. So many things happen that really shouldn't happen. And in our story, Hagar is an example of a woman exploited, abused, forced to flee without hope. The actions and inactions of Sarai and Abraham, they're abusive and they enable abuse. But in contrast, we see God who loves. God who sees, God who hears, God who reaches out even to the abused, to the lost, to the lonely, giving hope, a direction, and promise for herself, for her unborn son. As God's children, we must certainly have our attitudes like God's attitudes, to be instruments of his grace, to be instruments of his kindness, his generosity, and we do this through our support of Shine. If you are suffering abuse, if you need help, then call Shine. They are skilled at caring. If you find yourself growing angry, if you find yourself abusive towards a woman or a child, seek help. Turn to Shine. Connect with them, and they will be able to help you. Whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever your situation in life, God sees, God hears, God cares. There is hope to be found in Jesus. Amen.